This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Suan. It's been an eventful few days of gatherings and protests. On Saturday, we saw the Lawan protest, which took place in our capital city, where young Malaysians, mostly young Malaysians, took to the streets to voice out their frustrations with the Perikatan National Administration. Yesterday, we saw opposition MPs gathering at Dataran Merdeka to because they were blocked from entering Parliament. And what is a common thread between these two recent events is that the Lawan protests attempted to gather at Dataran Merdeka, but they weren't able to because it was cordoned off by the police earlier in the morning. And yesterday, the opposition's MP had gathered at Dataran Merdeka, and we've seen a lot of past protests also use Dataran Merdeka as this sort of central meeting point, especially when gatherings or protests are happening in KL. So that's what we want to explore today, you know, the significance of symbolic locations like the Dataran, as well as how urban design can come in when it, how urban design is relevant when it comes to protests. And joining me to discuss today's topic is Dr. Nurul Azrin Azlan, a senior lecturer in the Masters of Sustainable Urban Design program at UTMKL. Thank you so much for joining me today, Azrin.
Thank you for having me.
Perhaps let's start with a bit of a basic question. I think a lot of people would be wondering, you know, what does urban design have to do with protests and people's participation in public life in a democracy?
Right. So, first, clarification of terms. Urban design is actually what bridges architecture and urban planning. So it's quite a specific term. And this is something that many professionals in the built environment actually practice. The moment they design like an ensemble of buildings, you know, like a master plan, or when they think about the spaces in between buildings, right? So perhaps what is in question here is not really about urban design per se, but rather it's about how the built environment can actually shape people's participation in public life. So, and it does that by enabling or disabling certain activities. And of course, when we talk about democracy, it's about the ability to come together as a public. So it's technically, it's essentially about access. And the way we design our built environment determines this ease of access so people can gather.
So then how perhaps does urban design, the built environment then influence how a protest happens or its impact?
When you allow people to come together, right? So when we talk about, usually people, when we talk about protests, we talk about people coming together. And when people come together, this usually takes place in open spaces, in public spaces, right? So how does it do that? Public space is crucial because it allows people to come together in a large group. And democracy is not just about one person, right? It's about consensus. It's about the negotiations, the discussions, and the squabbles. You know, it's a messy thing. You know, so a good public space is robust enough to allow this to happen, and for it to maintain its robustness, it has to maintain its freedom, which means that it has to be public in the true sense, you know. So when things like capital start creeping into public space, and when public spaces start getting commodified, for example, or when companies, for example, or corporations produce these so-called pseudo public spaces, then we can start seeing certain activities which are deemed unproductive. They wouldn't want these activities to take place there, right? So you then only get a certain kind of people because they are seen as the right kind of public for these spaces.
And you said it has to be public in the true sense. Could you clarify a bit more? What does that mean for a space to be truly considered public?
So it has to be... it cannot be determined or it cannot be governed by the market, basically. You know, it cannot be produced by this private company. So I think a good example of this kind of space in KL would be KLCC Park, for example. You know, I think a lot of people don't actually realize that it's actually a private space. And there's actually a lot of things that you cannot do there. You know, if you go to the park, you know, you can see like a long list of things that you cannot do there, right? And if you were to do something and the guard would come and tell you off, like, hey, you cannot do this here. So essentially, you don't have the recourse, right? Because it's private space, you know. They have full ownership of the space. You just have to follow what they want, right? But for example, in Dataran Merdeka also, because it has its own set of bylaws, so it also has like a long list of things that you cannot do there without consent. So for example, you cannot like eat or drink on the dataran essentially without consent from the custodian of the space, without consent from the mayor. But if you were to do this there, because it's publicly owned, then you have this recourse, right? You can contest this because it is supposed to be public in that sense.
So I guess it's for it to be truly public means that there is no sort of restrictions around what people can do. But I guess that's almost like a utopia, right? Because a lot of public spaces still have restrictions. You know, you go to any public park and you'll see signs, or countries will have laws that say, oh, for example, you can't smoke or drink in public spaces.
Yeah.
You know, you brought up Dataran Merdeka, so let's just dive into it, right? When it comes to protests in Malaysia, one of the most significant, or perhaps the most significant location is the Dataran. We've seen that in the recent protests, we've seen that in the past as well. What is the significance of that location? You know, is it simply because of its historical significance in our country's independence, or is there more to it than that?
Well, yeah, in terms of protest logistics, I guess Dataran Merdeka is sort of perfect, because not only it has all of this history, right, this history, the symbol of emancipation from colonial rule, and also a rich history of dissent, right, I mean, from the reformative time and way beyond that as well, but it also happens to be the most accessible public space, open space in the city. Right. I mean, you can get to it through various ways. You know, there's a lot of options. You know, you can drive, you can whatever. Right. You can also come from many directions. And it is also surrounded by a mix of land use. You know, you have all of these shops, all of these hotels, eateries, which essentially support the activity of coming together. And it also, and because of this mix of functions, it also has a ready audience, right? There's always already people in the city. So, and of course, when you have people in the city, then some of them might be compelled to like, hey, maybe I should join this march or whatever, right? And I think that sometimes it's actually easier to think about it maybe in comparison with other places. And I always like to think about it in comparison with Putrajaya, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because if we look at Putrajaya, it is a city which is designed for administration,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you look at the boulevard, it is laden with symbols. So if you talk about symbol, then you know Putrajaya also has all of this symbolism. It also has all of these open spaces, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, why don't people protest there?
That's right.
Because it's just difficult to get to, you know. And of course, without this mix of functions, there's only like one particular use there, right? There's only one particular program there, which is like administration. It's just like civil servants going to work, right? So this would be your audience. And I think it's a bit difficult to get them to come down and also be part of the protest. And also, I mean, I know that a lot of people say that, you know, protest has always been part of our culture, part of our history. But we have to remember that this history is also constantly disrupted, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this narrative is also constantly disrupted. That I think slowly we are gaining back, you know, this ease to go to the streets and everything. Which is why if you look at many protests that take place in Malaysia, it always takes place on a weekend,
mm-hmm.
right? So like Lawan took place on a Saturday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And very rarely these things actually take place on a weekday. I mean, yesterday, of course, it's because these people can't get to the parliament, right? So I don't think it was like, I mean, the conditions sort of allowed it to happen. So if people were to go to Putrajaya to protest on a Saturday, who would be there to see it?
So there's that issue of, there's that angle of visibility.
Yes, that's that angle of visibility. And of course, you know, when we talk about, I like that you mentioned visibility, because the visual aspect of it, especially now, in this time, you know, when we have the internet and everything, is so very important, because the image actually travels, right? Image of the protest travels. You know, you go to the streets, you take pictures, you take videos, and then these images then get, you know, shared online and whatever. So if you want to fill up this space, this 100 meter boulevard in Putrajaya, you would need a lot of people for it not to look sad. So the logistics is super important in this sense, you know. I mean, it might seem cynical to think about it this way, you know, like it's. But then essentially, it is really very important, right? The visual quality of it is so very important.
Let's go for a very quick break now and continue our discussion after this. And, you know, I want to touch more on that, whether visibility is a double-edged sword and issues and you know, what it means when Dataran Merdeka is cordoned off and protests then happen in the vicinity of the Dataran, which we've seen happen recently and in the past. I'm speaking today to Dr. Nurul Azrin Azlan, a senior lecturer in the Masters of Sustainable Urban Design Program at UTMKL, and we're talking about the relationship between protests and public spaces and how urban design comes in. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Keep it here on Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Su Ann. On the line with me today is Dr. Nurul Azrin Azlan, a senior lecturer in the Masters of Sustainable Urban Design program at UTMKL. And we're discussing the power of protest in public spaces. And in particular in Malaysia, that would be Dataran Merdeka, which we've seen happen in recent and past protests. You know, before the break, we were talking about the symbolicism of Dataran Merdeka, you know, why that location is often chosen over Putrajaya, where the administration side of things happen. Now, we've seen in several instances protesters being stopped from occupying the square, from gathering at the Dataran, you know, where it was cordoned off early on. That was on Saturday. We've seen that in previous birthday rallies, where we then see the protesters gathering in the vicinity of the Dataran, in the roads leading up to the square. What does it signify, I guess, when people aren't allowed access to what is considered or is seen as a public space? And how does the built environment of KL then affect how the protests are then carried out when the Dataran is not accessible?
Okay, so maybe I'll just start with the impact of, you know, when the Dataran is cordoned off and people can't actually access the space, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the thing about the Dataran is how, you know, if you look at the history, right, it has this history of being a symbol of emancipation from colonial rule. And since then, I would argue that it, I mean, of course, the term Dataran Merdeka is like in the square of independence, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how independent is it really, you know, in terms of its spirit? Because since independence, if you look at how the space has actually evolved, you know, the authorities would always aim to preserve it, right? So we are preserving it as a symbol of emancipation. So it has to be like this pristine, a beautiful space.
Mm-hmm.
But is that really truly independent in terms of its spirit, right? Because for it to be truly embracing its spirit of independence, that it has to be truly public.
Mm.
So by cordoning off people from actually entering the space during this protest, you are sort of amplifying this this symbolism, you know, and not really the spirit of independence. And we can say that it also, when people actually occupy these street spaces, you know, these are the spaces that people actually use daily life, you know. I think most people would actually go through Jalan Tumperak more than they would actually go onto the Dataran.
That's right.
They would really go through Jalan Tunku Abdul Rahman more, you know. And very rarely actually people go onto the Dataran unless they are passing by or, you know, for whatever reason, right? It's not really a space that people actually use daily.
Whereas around it, you have a lot of foot traffic, you have a lot of cars, vehicles passing by on a daily basis.
Yeah, because of the functions, of course. You know, you have all the shops, all of these eateries. And by not allowing people to occupy or to enter the Dataran, you are basically sort of highlighting this distance between the spirit of the place and also like the symbolism, right? So so when people actually occupy these road spaces, these junctions, they are essentially occupying these like these spaces of everyday life, you know, which is then I guess it makes sense because the people, you know, then use these spaces of everyday life, whereas this symbolic space then remains empty. And I guess it's also like it's empty in terms of its meaning as well, because it's a symbol.
And it's, so is it then a different sort of visibility than, for example, if protesters do fill up the Dataran versus the protesters filling up the streets around the Dataran?
It is quite different. And I find that actually the impact is actually bigger when protesters cannot enter the Dataran because there's this struggle, right? And I would also argue that a protest doesn't start the moment people hit the street. It starts way before. It starts during the period of mobilization. It starts during when these organizers are negotiating with the custodian of the space, negotiating with the police, for example. I mean, right now they no longer have to apply for a permit, right? Under the Peaceful Assembly Act 2012. The moment of protest actually starts there. And when it is publicized, you know, when it is shared in the media, then to me, that is when the protest starts, way before people start going to the street.
Is visibility also a double-edged sword when it comes to, you know, because you have greater visibility for the media, for the public who are seeing what's happening, but there's also greater visibility for the people who may be surveilling what's happening?
Yeah, there's always that that risk, but I think that's also what lends protests the legitimacy as well. You know, there's because of this risk, right? Then it's not just like a leisurely thing that you do with your friends. There's actually a risk involved. There's actually a cost involved. So yes, it's a double-edged sword, but it's also what basically lends the protest its legitimacy.
So, you know, you mentioned earlier that the protests don't start when people take to the streets. It starts when, you know, the information starts going out that it's happening. And we see that nowadays happening a lot through social media. A lot of all the information is passed out through social media days, weeks before it happens. Do public spaces then still matter when it comes to protests, to people's participation in public life, in democratic processes, you know, such as their right to freedom of expression, right to peaceful assembly? Do public spaces matter when we have online spaces?
I would actually argue that it matters even more now because the thing with these online spaces is that what happens when they just shut it down, right? I mean, this happened in Egypt, right? Like, they just, like, I'm going to shut down the internet.
and we saw that happening in Myanmar as well.
Exactly. So then the only recourse that you have then is actually to go to the streets. So it is actually so very important. And we have to maintain this. It is actually especially important now because of the currency of online spaces, of social media is your attention span, right? A lot of content is being produced day in, day out, you know. Every second, you know, somebody is tweeting something. Somebody is like, you know, Instagramming or whatever. So if you look at the timeline, there's a constant stream of things. And if you were to, how do you capture the attention of people? How do you make sure that they care more about your cause more than like 30 seconds? Right. So so this is when actually going to the streets matter because it's about like, again, I mean, before this, I mentioned the cost. Right. I mean, tweeting is easy. You know, you just take your phone and then you type and then you send the tweet. Right. It's posted. But if you were to go to the streets, there's a lot of considerations that need to happen. Right. So And this is what I think actually contributes to people paying more attention to it because they are aware that there's more cost involved in actually going to the streets, right? So when they see like images of people protesting in the streets, the thing would remain with them a bit more longer, right? And of course, these images then get transmitted. You know, people keep sharing. You know, and if you look from the protests on Saturday, you know, things get retweeted. You know, and everything, and it sparks another discussion as well, right? Like people started talking about it. You know, people were against it. People were for it, and then you start talking about the cause more and more. Right. Whereas, you know, if you just see a tweet or, you know, for example, you're like, I'm not interested in this. I'm just going to mute it. Right. And then you no longer know about it. But if things were already on the streets and then these things get transmitted and they might not always use these hashtags, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it will seep into like people's consciousness. And I think that is so very important.
And that then generates that part of democracy, which is the discourse between people, right? It doesn't matter whether you support it or you don't. It's generating that discussion of what this means. How then does, you know, rapid urbanization, as what we have seen in KL, what we've seen in a lot of cities across the world, how does that affect the accessibility of these spaces for people?
Well, I guess it depends on how the urbanization happens. I think in KL, because it's always a bit haphazard, you know, I mean, in central KL, I think I have to credit DBKL. I think they have done quite a good job in like upgrading these spaces on Jalan Tuk Abdul Rahman, you know, Masjid Indah and everything. But if we just look at things like sprawl, for example, you know, because, you know, it's expensive to live in the city,
mm-hmm.
right? And but people still go to cities because that's where the opportunities are, right? But they can't really afford to live in the city. So then they live in the outskirts. So then you spend more time commuting, which basically doesn't leave you much time to actually participate in public life, right? Because you're too tired. After work, you need to just leave and go home because it's a long commute, you know. I have to be on the road for an hour, for example, which I think for most people is already quite normal, an hour commuting time. And for some, it takes longer. But yeah, I mean, then KL is still like the locus of activities. This is how actually, if urbanization were to happen in a haphazard way, then it has the potential of actually limiting people's participation in public life in that sense.
So then what cities would you hold up as examples of, you know, a good built environment that, you know, facilitates people participation in public life?
Okay, I don't want to mention any one city. I think we can all, somebody might just say, oh, that city is not so great because of this and that. But maybe the criteria, right?
Mm-hmm.
Essentially any metropolis or big cities that would have like a good mix of land use. You know, you have like a lot of things happening at the same time. And are accessible, you know, you have like options of getting into the city and the opportunity cost is lower. And these cities would usually also have like good public spaces, you know, so that people can gather, right? But of course, the built environment is only one aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the city might have all of this, but still, I mean, we wouldn't say that it's a thriving democracy. There are also some cities which are essentially, you know, in terms of like accessibility and access to space, it's quite good. But because the legislation doesn't really allow for this to happen, that it still doesn't happen. So good environment, good urban design is only one aspect of it. But that doesn't mean that we should disallow it, because what's the point of having like laws that say that you can gather, but you wouldn't, because it's just so difficult to do that.
Hmm. And, you know, and I guess why is it important for us to think about, you know, to give thought to urban design, to the built environment, when we and to think about public participation when these things are considered? Because we're not just talking about protests, right, as part of public participation. We're talking about a more general understanding of people's ability to take part in democratic processes.
Yeah. So yeah, protest is just I think it's a good lens to sort of evaluate, you know, public space in terms of democracy, because it is like the like one of the more visible form of like coming together. But of course, it is very important for public space to allow people to just come together on an everyday basis, right? Because then you're exposed to other people as well, you know, not just your bubble, right? You see how other people live. And you might care a bit more about like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm quite lucky and I should care about, you know, these people who are not so lucky, right? And we don't know, right? I mean, we might also one day end up on the streets, right? And we can only hope that the streets would be kind to us. But that is why, you know, I think it, again, the publicness of the space matters in terms of like who owns and who runs it. Because, you know, space doesn't have to be privately owned to act like a private space, if you get what I mean. I mean, if you have a public space which is publicly owned, but because of the way it is run, you know, it still disallows certain spaces, certain activities to happen, because these activities are deemed not productive, right? So, for example, like, people who are sleeping rough, these are deemed as, you know, not productive activities.
Mm-hmm.
So then most people would probably not want people to sleep rough in the streets, because, you know, these people are not spending or whatever, right? But then, you know, I mean, a good public space should be robust enough that it can actually allow many activities to happen, you know, and it actually can offer comfort and support to those in need of these spaces.
And perhaps one final question, Azrin. You know, what can we do better to protect our public spaces here in Malaysia, especially in our capital city?
I would argue that you need to like actually use it more. <You
know? laughs> I think a lot of us don't go out enough.
Yeah, we don't go out enough. And I think for most people also, it's easy to go to malls, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because
they're air-conditioned.
Yeah, it's air-conditioned, you know, there's parking, you know, there's all, there's like restaurants, you know, there's even like, you know, gymnasiums or whatever, movies. And but this, of course, a mall is like, you know, it's really directed towards consumption, right? That's how it functions. it is quite dangerous if we just like flock to malls and not like use our public space, because then what we do is we are basically sending the signal that yeah, we want more malls. I mean, I think a lot of people are actually upset that there are more malls now, right? But yeah, I mean that's how the market works, right? And yeah, we need to be aware of what's happening in our area. You know, if you see any new development, or if you see any like new billboard coming up saying that there's a new development, then you have to know what's going on. And usually they have this period where you can actually submit your bantahan, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you feel that this development is not suitable, then you should do something about it, you know, and mm-hmm. not just submit the bantahan, but also like, you know, take it to social media, for example. So you have to care more about where you live.
Mm-hmm. And that itself is part of public participation.
Exactly. Yes, it's citizenship, right? So citizenship is not just about having an IC or a passport, right? It's about your participation in where you live, you know. So I would argue that citizenship actually is not really about the documents, right? It's about how you live your everyday life. And actually, we also vote every time we do something, because we vote for the life that we want everybody to have.
I think that's a lot of food for thought there. You know, all our actions actually indicate, you know, our wants. All right. Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Azrin.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking to Dr. Nurul Azrin Azlan, Senior Lecturer in the Masters of Sustainable Urban Design Program at UTMKL. And we've been talking about the role of public spaces when it comes to facilitating public participation. And we've also been talking about it through the lens of looking at it through the lens of protests that have happened in Malaysia. You've been listening to Live and Learn with me, Lim Suan, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.